So I've started doing little mini horror reviews.
Yes, that's what it was I wanted to mention. Yeah. Yes. I think people seem to be loving those.
I'm so glad. Honestly, it's something I'd kind of been toying with for a while because before we go to bed every night, Steve and I will put on a movie.
Yeah.
And for the first time in my life, I'm with someone who loves to watch scary stuff.
Amazing.
So we watch a lot of horror movies. We watch a lot of really just messed up movies and weird stuff. And there's been so many times where I have all these thoughts, but I'm not on social media as much as I used to be lately. Like, I don't have a Twitter, don't really post on Instagram. Mm-hmm. I'm just not active. So I started kind of just posting them on our socials.
Yeah.
And people are sending me recommendations. I love it. And yeah, I think it's something I'm going to start doing from now on. Because if we're watching them all the time, why not?
I think it's great. You're getting some great suggestions.
Yeah.
It started to remind me of like movies I've watched. Because like you said, it's not just about like the good horror movies.
Yes.
It's about everything. And you guys know there's some cheesy ass horror movies out there, but two that came to mind that were cheesy and then just really weird. And we watched these in the kind of early days of Netflix.
Okay.
One of them was called Rubber.
Oh my God, Rubber. Yes.
About this sentient psychopathic tire.
I've never actually watched it. I've just seen the trailer.
I've watched it all the way through.
Okay.
It's bizarre. But well worth a watch.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't even know how to explain it. It's just an experience. You got to watch it.
I love it.
And then the other one that's one of my favorites, and Cody and Shane quote it to me quite often, is Mammoth.
I haven't seen that either.
It's amazing. The premise is it's a woolly mammoth that's in a museum.
Okay.
And I believe what it is, an alien like takes it over.
Okay.
And then this rampaging mammoth is like going around. But the twist is it uses its trunk to like suck your soul out to get like more powerful.
These are the movies I want to be watching.
Yeah. So for you for you guys out there, Rubber and Mammoth. And then just one that I haven't seen, but everyone says I need to watch, is Teeth.
I haven't seen Teeth either, but I know what it's about.
Shane, again, quotes it to me a lot. I think it's one of his favorite weird horror movies. I'm not going to spoil it if you haven't seen it. But yeah, Teeth's another sort of cult classic weird one that we should watch.
And please keep commenting your suggestions on the post. Let me know. I will watch them. If I can find them, I will watch them. And I am excited because I feel like I've seen so many.
Yes.
But there's so many more out there.
One thing before we do get started, the thing I love about your little reviews is that they're like short, sweet, to the point. You're like, yes, this was good. It entertained me. It was cheesy.
Yeah.
Like, I love that.
I'm so glad.
I don't need to know about the script writing and the cinematography.
It's horror.
That's all great. And there's some great cinematic horrors out there. But my baseline is, did it entertain me?
Yeah.
So, yeah, send them.
Perfect. Yeah, keep them coming because I love it.
All righty. So, hello, everyone. I'm Charlotte.
And I'm Dina. Welcome to the Grim Curriculum.
So, we had a lot of fun with our last old-timey case, and we figured it's never too soon to jump into another one. After all, I think they're our favorite.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No doubt. And funny thing about this one is I messaged Charlotte the night before recording, and I was like, dude, like, I can't find anything. It's going to be a short one. Like, I did my best. And right after I sent that, I found this amazing archive of information. This is going to end up being one of our longest episodes, I think.
Crazy.
Just because of how much I found, I am so excited because a lot of this stuff is not talked about when it comes to this lady. So it's going to be a lot of information, but it is a fascinating story.
She's completely new to me, and when you mentioned wanting to cover her in our next set of episodes, I immediately Googled, and oh boy, what a jump scare that is.
Yeah, so if you Google her, there's a specific photo that comes up, and it is like a fan art kind of thing.
Yes, it's more of a sketch than anything.
Yes, but the actual photos of her, I would say, are quite as... she wasn't a looker, I'll give her that.
Oh boy. Well, we'll get into it.
This episode is also a first for us because we have never covered a South African true crime story.
No, I don't think we have. And to be fair, not many really come to mind. It's definitely one that I haven't looked into a whole lot. So, yeah, I guess for those of you watching, if you're from the area, of South Africa, the huge area.
Yes.
The country of South Africa. If you're from South Africa and there's cases or monsters or things you want us to cover, please send them in.
I want to hear about some South African cryptids.
Oh, yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, without further ado, today we are going to be talking about Daisy de Melker, also known as the Black Widow of South Africa. Her financially motivated crimes led to the deaths of three people, but she would ultimately only be convicted of one murder.
It's been a while since we've covered a Black Widow, and while Daisy wasn't responsible for as many deaths as some of the people we talk about, she still took the lives of quite a few innocent people for the sole purpose of giving herself a better life.
I feel like, and this is purely anecdotal opinion, I think a lot of the female killers and female creepy people we talk about tend to have these sort of very innocent sounding names, like Daisy, for example.
My bird was Daisy.
Yeah.
That's what I think of, is I think of a sweet little cockatiel.
Absolutely. And so, I mean, her full name, as she was born, Daisy Louisa Hancorn Smith.
And a quick little interruption here for you.
Mm.
Her case was so notorious that when she was born, Daisy was more of a popular name in the area.
Oh.
It took about a whole generation of people until her name was common once again.
Whoa.
After her case, people stopped naming their kids Daisy for many, many years.
Holy cow. To have that much of an effect?
Oh, yeah.
Crazy. So she was born June 1st, 1886, in the village of Seven Fountains, about 40 miles from Grahamstown. While Grahamstown was somewhat of a booming frontier town built in an area where leopard, lynx, and other animals roamed just outside, Seven Fountains was a cluster of small homesteads filled with farmers.
The area was mainly populated by British settlers who had only arrived about 60 years prior. Daisy's parents were among those who arrived in the area in an attempt to earn a comfortable life farming. Their small house had no electricity or running water, which was par for the course there. Even so, the people who lived in Seven Fountains were quite happy and often never left.
Daisy was her parents' sixth child and would be followed by five more. 11 kids. Ooh-ee.
And when she was born, they were already struggling to feed the kids that they had.
And then continued to have five more.
Yeah.
Holy cow. In total, the family would consist of seven girls and four boys. As a young child, Daisy was considered to be quite pretty, with large blue eyes. But it is noted that she had dark and wavy hair, which was often difficult to manage and quite messy. I can relate to that.
Yeah, that's fair. It's something that would last well into her life that she would be known for.
See, I got a grip on mine sometime around my, I don't know, teen years.
Same. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So
Daisy had also been born with a split palate, which made speech difficult. Despite all of this, she was considered to be very bright and made friends easily. By the time she was eight, her father began to talk about going north.
Back then, when a man said that, he meant that he was going off to become a gold prospector. At the time, gold was plentiful in the area, and many men had made their own small fortunes prospecting. In his mind, this was probably the only way out of their poverty-stricken lifestyle. It's going back to the rabbit incident.
It is.
The things that you will do, the back-breaking insanity that you will do in the prospect of a better life for you and your family. It's just so not fair.
Right? It's a lot.
It is a lot.
He set off to what is now known as Zimbabwe with his two oldest sons, leaving the rest of the family behind. It seems as if life was much better there. He often wrote home, and soon word began to spread. Many families from Seven Fountains set out to join him. At the age of 10, Daisy was sent out to live with him and her brothers.
The reasoning for this is unknown. One possibility was an upcoming war. Her mother may have decided that Daisy would be safer up north. However, it's unclear why she sent only Daisy and did not join him with the other children.
It's also likely that Daisy was sent because someone was needed to help take care of the men.
That did cross my mind.
I think that's the war was brewing and it will break out very soon. But I think at the end of the day, they needed someone to cook, to clean, to sew, and Daisy was likable.
Okay.
She was smart, and they were like, well, take this one.
She seems easygoing.
Yeah.
Oh.
Every day, she would be escorted to school, where she continued to gain an education that many children at the time would have not been privileged to.
In 1899, Daisy was sent to the Good Hope Seminary School, where she continued her education until 1903 and returned to Zimbabwe. This is when she met what would be considered her first love, a young man named Bert Fuller.
Bert was, by all accounts, a great catch. He was the Assistant Commissioner of Native Affairs, which is a job that not only paid well, it also guaranteed him a substantial pension. He lived in free government housing and had access to a number of servants as well as his own vehicle.
But Daisy, at 17 years old, was not ready to settle down. She said goodbye to Bert and began studying nursing in Durban. 3 years later, she returned despite not completing her nursing degree. By this point, she simply couldn't resist Bert and the perks that would come with marrying him, and the two quickly became engaged.
What she didn't know was that Bert had been transferred to the village of Metetsi. When she saw the difference in his quality of life, she asked that they postpone the wedding so that she could go back to school. At the time, it was quite likely for someone living in the area to die of various diseases such as malaria, dysentery, and so Bert decided to make a will. If he were to die, Daisy would not only get everything he owned, she would also gain his pension.
But they're not married at this point, right?
No, they are not.
So he has just willed everything to a person he is not legally bound to.
No.
That's pretty stupid, brazen, an unusual decision to make.
Yes.
I also get the vibe, and this is pure assumption, maybe you can confirm or deny.
Mm-hmm.
Daisy's 17, a couple of years have gone by, so she's like 17, 18, 19 maybe. Mm-hmm. Bert is like the assistant commissioner of whatever. I get the impression he's a lot older than her.
He actually wasn't that much older than her. He was just very successful. He's a younger guy. He has never been married.
Okay.
He's never really had many serious relationships. I thought the same thing,
okay,
too, because on paper, he sounds like an older man.
I would assume so, obviously.
But he was right around her age.
Well, then.
Which, for this time, I was kind of shocked by, because that's
usually, we often are.
Yes, exactly. But, yeah, no, he was maybe a couple of years older than her. That.
Okay, well, I'm happy to hear it.
Yeah.
This time around, she had enrolled in nursing school near Johannesburg. Just as she set to unpack her suitcase, she was given a telegram. Bert was not only sick, but he was likely dying. Daisy decided to set out to see him before it was too late.
When she got there, she realized how bad things had gotten. Bert had been diagnosed with Blackwater fever, a complication of malaria. She watched as he suffered with a fever that shot up so high, he was left babbling nonsense. Have you ever had a really, really high fever?
No, I haven't. I'm, knock on wood, my immune system, pretty great, actually. I might be blind as a bat and have other issues with hay fever and allergies, but my immune system's pretty good. I very rarely get colds or flus or anything.
Yeah.
Cody, though, often, actually, he's not doing so hot right now, but when he gets the flu and gets a fever, he has really, like, delirious dreams.
Okay.
And I'm a person who dreams pretty wildly anyway,
yeah,
but I've never had that level of fever at all.
I have, on two occasions, had really severe food poisoning.
Ooh.
And I'm not talking about like throwing up and stuff like,
yeah,
that. Like my fever was so high that I was just shaking for like 8
yes,
hours.
Yeah.
And I was shaking so hard that I couldn't sleep.
Oh my
the
God.
The fever was so bad. I could barely get words out. It like,
whoa,
it took all of my energy. I basically laid on the couch and just tried to make myself, I thought I was going to die.
I believe it. Yeah.
Like, it is unlike anything I've ever experienced. I am now so paranoid when it comes to food, but
no kidding.
The feeling of your body just burning up like that, where you're freezing and you're sweating,
yes,
this isn't a good way to go.
No, it's one of those things where it's your body's safeguarding itself, but in a way, and often the body does, is it's sinking the ship to kill,
yeah,
the captain,
exactly,
right? So like, it's making it so the bacteria or the virus in your system can't, like, is too hostile, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like, it's like, we're gonna make it so you can't live here.
Yeah.
But it also does damage to you as,
oh,
well.
Absolutely.
It can be really scary. And these days, I mean, not to get too far off topic, but when it comes to the flu and stuff, we don't often think too much about it. We're just,
no,
like, you know, couple of days off work or school, maybe a week tops, you're good.
Yeah.
But it can kill you.
And I, after experiencing that, I can see how.
Yes.
Because even afterwards, I was sick for probably 2 full days. And it took me a couple of weeks to fully recover from just being sick.
So, I mean, we're talking, you know, the early 1900s in the boonies of South Africa, and you've got black water fever. Someone come read you your rights, sir. Oh, yeah.
And they did. Because on March 2nd, 1907, the day that was set to be their wedding, Daisy watched as Bert was buried. Due to her grief, she didn't ask about the will. She instead returned to nursing school. That December, a letter from a lawyer arrived asking her to head back north to discuss the will.
Bert had left her 95 pounds, and this may not seem much by today's standards, but at the time, the average worker made about 4 pounds a week. This meant that if she was smart, Daisy would have enough to live off of for almost a year.
Which, I mean, she didn't get the pension.
Okay.
But she got that kind of life insurance money. And again, it's in that time for how most people were living, especially in the area, she was set for at least a little bit.
Well, and enough so that she could have, you know, gotten onto her feet, gotten maybe a little place to stay, figured out her shit, you know, finish her nursing, go on to work as a nurse. The 95 pounds wasn't quite what she expected, but she was fine with it and went back to Johannesburg to work as a nurse. By now, she was 22 and independent, which in those days was a rarity for a woman.
And I do. I mean, she is not a great person. We're going to see that. I appreciate her desire for education.
Yes, absolutely. I'm considering the very lowly beginning she's had and just the fact that her parents were farmers. She has all these siblings.
Yeah.
I'm surprised she even went to elementary school at this point. So, yeah, for the early 1900s to be fully qualified in working as a nurse independently as a 22-year-old woman, that's pretty fantastic.
It is. It's really pretty impressive. She was considered by both staff and patients to be an exceptional nurse. Her own experience with grief led her to be caring and understanding.
Sometime during 1908, she met 36-year-old William Alfred Cowell. Alf, as he liked to be known, was originally from the Isle of Man and had found work as a plumber in Johannesburg. His wage was more than that of a typical worker, and he was considered to be great husband material. The two became engaged on Christmas Day that year and were married on March 3rd, 1908, 1 day after the second anniversary of Bert's death. I mean, to be fair, picking the day for his funeral, you don't really have a choice.
No.
You know, when a person dies, and usually the funeral just comes shortly after. So, like, I can't pinpoint that there. But without knowing how grisly this is going to get, but knowing the topic of what we usually discuss, I would say it becomes pretty poignant that it almost seems like she's picking these days.
I know, right?
That's
probably
not the case
at
all.
No, not at all. And the thing, too, I read this whole fascinating thing about funeral practices at the time.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And we're talking about a place on Earth that is very hot.
Yes. Oh, and the Victorian black?
Yeah.
Mourning garb?
Oh, absolutely.
And I mean, I don't know if it would have been the same for someone of Daisy's class, if we want to put it that way. But Victorian women, when your husband passed away, you were expected to mourn and be in mourning with your full mourning garb for no less than a year.
Yeah.
And to be honest, that would have been considered like kind of short.
Oh, definitely.
Some people were in mourning, A, for the rest of their lives or like 3 years.
Yeah. And I mean, also in her defense with the funeral date and things like that, they weren't exactly storing these bodies. They weren't really.
No,
you know,
it's like you kind of got to get them in the ground.
Exactly, because otherwise you're going to have a bad time.
Yeah.
Together, they moved to number 22 Tully Street in Johannesburg. The house itself was modest, and the area had a reputation for being somewhat of an unhealthy place to live due to it being in the center of slime dumps from the gold mine.
I don't even know what that means. I've heard of like slag heaps from mining, but never slime dumps.
They said that they were like green slime dumps.
Yeah.
It was just all the leftover goo and I don't know, offshoots of whatever the heck they came up with while they were getting gold.
I'm going to have to look into this gold mining situation.
It's not something you'd want to be around.
No kidding. Alf suffered from a bad back and a weak stomach. He had spent most of his time in the Isle of Man eating boiled potatoes and herring, as is custom. But in South Africa, he was now surrounded by a diet of fatty meat and spicy stews. Because of this, he often found himself sick in some form or another.
I thought it was kind of funny in a really terrible way.
No, I think I already know what you're thinking, and I think it's funny too.
He basically goes to Daisy and he's like, I can't eat like this. I have constant diarrhea. This is terrible. I'm used to eating potatoes and fish.
Yep.
Your food is too spicy, Daisy. You need to tone it down. And she's like, I like it spicy.
Basically, for those of you who aren't familiar, Isle of Man is kind of its own, it's not its own nation, I don't believe, but it's just off the coast of England.
They have their own flag.
Yes, they kind of operate as their own thing, but I do believe, correct me if I'm wrong, of course, I mean no offense, I do think they are considered part of like the British Isles.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, he's this white British person showing up in South Africa and being like, oh, spices.
Oh yeah.
Oh no, Daisy, stop it.
In 1910, Daisy gave birth to twins. At the time, it wasn't possible to tell if a woman was carrying more than one child, so the birth came as a huge surprise to the couple, but they were happy. Tragically, the twins passed away soon after due to their low birth rate.
Aww. Soon after, though, Daisy found herself pregnant again. This time, she gave birth to a boy they named Rhodes Cecil. He was Daisy's pride and joy. In 1913, she gave birth to another boy they named Lester, and 2 years later, another boy they named Eric.
Lester passed away at the age of 4 due to an abscess on his liver. This was followed by the death of Eric for unknown reasons. At the time, the child mortality rate was quite high, and the couple was happy to have at least one child who had survived infancy.
Holy cow, no kidding.
Now, I'm sure people are thinking, there is zero evidence that
she
shows
had anything
that she's
to do
responsible
with it.
For
this. Okay.
This is, and the same thing with Bert.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It just is the reality of life at the time.
Oh, that's so rough. 4 years after the deaths of all but one of their children, the family moved to a new home in the heart of Johannesburg. By now, it was 1922, and Daisy was a stay-at-home mother and wife. Rhodes was now 11, and by all accounts was fairly spoiled by his mother.
Alf, who was 49 at the time, was in poor health. His stomach problems had gotten worse, likely due to Daisy's spicy cooking, and he often suffered from digestive issues, hemorrhoids, and a fistula.
That sucks.
Mm-hmm.
Poor guy. Soon after they moved, Alf went into the hospital to have surgery to help with his various ailments. Along with this, he often had attempted to heal himself with various concoctions that pharmacists had made up for him. Many of these medical syrups were one-offs, which meant that they were never quite the same each time. This led to him almost dying from the medicine that was supposed to be treating him.
Happened multiple times.
I mean, if you just got, like, some chemist or pharmacist just, like, whipping potions together, mm-hmm. basically. I mean, yeah, teaspoon here, a teaspoon there.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, that's fine when you're cooking, but not when you're playing Breaking Bad.
Daisy happily tended to her husband and confessed to neighbors that she was worried about his health. Alf had also developed issues with his sleep, and she urged him to go see a doctor. But he simply told her that real men did not run to the doctor because they didn't sleep well.
Classic.
Yeah.
Guys, if you're having the amount of problems that Alf is having, mm-hmm. it is no attack on your masculinity
no.
to see a medical professional. Please, for the love of God, swallow your pride.
He was fine to go to the pharmacist and just get these little
tonics. He just wanted these little solutions.
Off the or over-the-counter
kind of
stuff. He's fine with that, but he didn't want to actually be fully examined.
You can only take Pepto for a stomach ulcer for so long.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? On January 8th, 1923... Daisy finally convinced him to see a doctor. The day before his appointment, Alf woke up with stomach cramps that were so painful he could not get out of bed. When Daisy tried to talk to him, he was completely incoherent. She called upon their neighbors to help him, but when they arrived, they could only watch as he lay in bed vomiting, screaming in pain, and coughing.
His stomach issues had led to severe constipation, So Daisy helped him drink a mixture of Epsom salts, which at the time were commonly used as a laxative. She eventually called upon his doctor, who brought him some medication. Before the day was over, Alf was dead.
With the deaths of Bert and Alf, Daisy felt as if she had been widowed a second time. Well, you have, girl.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's two now.
I mean, not on paper. She didn't technically marry Bert.
I mean, that's true.
I mean, really, you're twice a widow.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say so. When the doctor arrived to issue a death certificate, he felt as if something was off and pushed for an autopsy. The report stated the cause of death as Bright's syndrome, a disease of the kidneys.
Foul play was not suspected, and Daisy was allowed to bury her husband of 14 years. She was heartbroken, but also well aware of the fact that her husband's paychecks would no longer be something she could rely on.
Luckily, Daisy had convinced Alf to create a will that would leave everything to her. This came out to a little over £1,245, which amounts to about 40 grand in today's money, along with an additional pension of what would now amount to almost 20,000 Canadian dollars. He had also purchased the house in her name. Needless to say, Daisy was set up for life.
I was shocked that he bought it in her name.
That reminds me of Ed Gein's mother.
Ooh, it does, yeah.
Being the sole proprietor of their little shop and everything.
Yeah.
Which again, in those days, a little later in time than Daisy's story for sure, but still unusual considering women couldn't really have bank accounts and stuff, right? So yeah, it's funny, these little connections.
Even with her newfound wealth, Daisy decided that she wanted to return to work. It had been some time since she had been a nurse, so she had to start back at the bottom and became a porter in a children's hospital.
Fun fact for you guys, the hospital that she worked in claims that her spirit now haunts it and says that her ghost will often appear near the bed of a sick child shortly before their death. They talk about this to this day.
I thought that was a fun little side fact.
I mean, anybody that's worked in a hospital or even been in a hospital for any amount of time, it's one of those spooky liminal sort of places, especially at night.
Mm-hmm.
And any medical professional, even the most scientifically minded of doctors and nurses, will be like, there's spooky things that we can't explain in hospitals.
My mom is retired now, but she used to work at a senior's home. And she would tell me all the time, like, elevators would open on their own, doors would kind of move a little bit. Yeah. And she's not like a super superstitious person, but I think, like we always say, if places are going to be haunted, it's going to be places like that.
Absolutely. I mean, think of all the souls that go through a hospital.
Daisy enjoyed her new job, but her life was suddenly turned upside down when it became evident that Rhodes, now 12, was suffering from his own medical issues. He had been diagnosed with epilepsy and what would now be considered as a learning disability.
She blamed his teachers for his learning issues and sent him to one of South Africa's most prestigious private schools. He stayed there for a year and returned without passing a single exam. She then sent him to another school where he stayed for 3 years, but returned home without any official diplomas.
Daisy then decided that Rhodes, now 16, would set out to become a plumber just like his late father.
Speaking of plumbers, it was around this time that Daisy would meet her second official husband, 46-year-old Robert Sproat. Robert had been a co-worker of Alf's. He was described as a sassy dresser with a fondness for beer.
I really tried to find what they meant by sassy dresser, and I wasn't even sure if I should put that in there, but it paints a picture.
I don't know if it's like a good thing or a bad thing, because to me, if you said like sassy, my mind immediately jumped to like smart and like very put together.
Okay.
But I could also see it in kind of like, maybe like sassy being maybe like more eccentric, like he didn't care.
I'm picturing a lot of frilly shirts. Daisy was looking for a husband, and he checked the boxes that she needed, so she began to pursue him. Above all else, she missed having the companionship of a partner, as well as help with Rhodes. There are a bunch of things that I found that basically talk about, and of course, a woman during this time, they're going to take this angle.
Oh,
I mean, they
sure
do now, but apparently she was quite... This is how it was worded.
Okay.
In the old-timey article I found, she was quite accomplished in bed.
How would you fucking know?
A lot of her partners, while they were with her, that's what they would say, is she had a very active libido.
Okay.
And she was good at it. It was easy for her to woo him.
Which, not to like compare everything to everything, Catherine Knight.
Mm-hmm.
Because the men couldn't seem to stay away from her either, and no. She was horrible to mm-hmm. them, but they still kept coming back.
Yep.
Yeah. Daisy and Robert were married on July 1st, 1926. The two signed the same marriage contract that Daisy had with Alf, meaning that if Robert died, she'd get all of his money too.
At the time, they had two different types of marriage contracts that you could sign.
Okay.
Kind of like how it is now. But basically, the first kind, which was the more common one, was if the husband died, the wife would get whatever she had going into the marriage.
Okay, fair, yeah.
And the second one was the husband dies, wife gets everything.
Okay.
And she heavily pushed towards the side where she gets everything. Where, I mean, she has a child.
Absolutely.
I get it. I think most women would push for that.
It's very sus based on, obviously, the context of mm-hmm. this story, this case. But to be honest, like, if Cody died, you're damn right I'd want everything.
Yeah.
There's just the two of us.
Yeah.
Who else is it going to if it's not coming to me? Sorry. Like,
yeah.
So it's one of those things where it's like, yeah, it's a beige flag in this story,
mm-hmm.
but realistically, not really.
Yeah.
So it turned out, with Daisy getting all of Robert's money in the end, he actually did have a decent amount of it to have. He had invested in stocks, and his shares alone were enough to buy two large houses. Robert moved in with Daisy and Rhodes, and things quickly went south. Rhodes was very difficult to get along with, and like we mentioned before, he was very spoiled, and by now had essentially given up on the idea of ever becoming a plumber. Daisy continued to buy him whatever he wanted and made up excuses for his bad behavior.
Much like Alf, Robert also had digestive issues. He preferred various pharmaceutical concoctions as well over actual medical advice. Shouldn't come as a shock that he also developed some of the same issues.
It just occurred to me, and this is just speculation, mm-hmm. but in those days, I'm imagining the kind of old-timey concoctions. You know, everything had heroin and cocaine in it.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking they're probably giving him some kind of mixture to help with pain, mm-hmm. which probably involves some kind of opiate.
Yes.
They're probably getting addicted to opiates, therefore continuing to go back to the same pharmacist that's hooking them up. The opioid stress on their body is not going to help their digestive system.
No, definitely
not. Anyone that's been on T3s or any kind of narcotic painkiller for a surgery or something, that shit will bung you up.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, he's probably getting like a little bit of pain relief for whatever shit is going on in his guts, but he's probably addicted mm-hmm. and it's probably making it worse in the long run.
And you have to remember, we'll talk about this in a little bit, but he's also drinking heavily.
Oh, well, that's not good either.
Yeah. In June of 1927, Robert and Daisy were preparing for their first wedding anniversary when he collapsed. He told her that he was having severe pains in his side. The doctor was called to the house 3 times in 3 days and diagnosed Robert with indigestion. He was prescribed medication and expected to make a full recovery.
Do you ever just collapse with indigestion?
Right?
God damn it. Oh. Shortly after, the doctor was called yet again to the house because Robert had collapsed. This time, he examined him further and concluded that high blood pressure and a heart condition were the problem. The doctor explained that the likely cause of this was due to Robert being in constant contact with lead while working as a plumber.
Which made sense.
Yeah, I'm sure it didn't help.
This was a common ailment of men in his profession. The doctor had no reason to suspect anything otherwise. Robert, on the other hand, wasn't buying it. He stayed in bed for a few days, but returned to work soon after.
Also kind of reminds me of, like, in those days, like, plumbers dealt with lead. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the reason we say, like, mad hatters, because they worked with mercury.
Mm-hmm.
All these different professions just working with, like, hella toxic materials.
Yeah.
Or, like, people that worked in, like, asbestos mines
yeah.
or whatever. It's like, oh, we're just all handling basically uranium mm-hmm. all the time. Along with all of his other issues, Robert also had bad teeth. On October 8th, he had 2 teeth extracted and was given chloroform, as was the norm. He returned home with his mouth still bleeding and struggled to sleep through the night. The following day, he took Daisy for a drive, but they returned home soon after because he was still bleeding. He went into the bathroom to gargle with some mouthwash, and as he went to get into their bed, he passed out.
Daisy called the doctor. Again, we're going to be saying that a lot in this story.
I mean, the doctor's making bank at this point.
Oh, yeah. By the time he arrived, Robert was screaming in pain. He gave him an injection to help and left. Daisy called him back half an hour later, saying that Robert was still suffering greatly. He gave him another injection, not saying what it was, and prescribed him some medication.
Robert's best friend, a fellow plumber named Billy Johnson, arrived at the house soon after. Daisy had called him to say Robert was in a lot of pain and that she didn't know what to do. Daisy then called Robert's brother William and advised him to get on the first train to Johannesburg to visit his brother on his deathbed.
By this point, Robert was certain that he was dying. He remembered that he had not made a will since before he and Daisy were married and told Billy that she was his only heir.
At about 4 a.m., his brother arrived, and Robert told him about the will, and a few hours later, with the assistance of his brother, the updated will was written out.
To everyone's shock, Robert began to feel better. A few days later, he was back to work, and he was issued a new pharmaceutical tonic, which gave him the energy to do his job.
Probably meth at this point.
Right? Like, honestly, yeah.
How about some amphetamines? That'll put the spirit back in you.
Yeah.
Weeks passed, and then a month, and Robert seemed to be doing fine. By November 6, he was still struggling with digestive issues, so he took some of the tonic and then had some beer for good measure. He had taken Daisy for a drive, and when they arrived back home, Robert settled into the living room while she prepared his lunch.
Rhodes had been in the garden, but upon becoming overheated, he went to join his stepfather in the living room. He found him on the sofa, sweating heavily. He screamed for his mother, and the two were unable to wake Robert, so they called the doctor.
Upon seeing him, the doctor stated that Robert had likely suffered a stroke and was dying.
The doctor left the room to consult with a colleague. When he returned, Robert was dead. Daisy told him that she thought that he had a heart attack, but the doctor's official conclusion was a cerebral hemorrhage.
And just like that, Daisy was a widow once again. This time she knew what to do. She called the same undertaker she had used for Alf and had him buried next to her first husband. Robert had left Daisy more than Bert and Alf had together, somewhere in the sum of $185,000 Canadian in today's money, along with his car.
With that, Daisy was what people then would consider comfortably off. 6 months after the death of her second husband, she set off on a long vacation to England. Rhodes, still unemployed, had failed his plumbing exam and went along with her.
For 3 months, the two toured England and stayed with various friends and relatives. Overall, they seemed to have a great time, but Daisy was overheard complaining to friends about Rhodes making her buy him a motorbike. They know.
She can't.
Ugh.
She does not say no to this child.
From personal experience, I know that this is a problem.
Yeah.
Say no to your children sometimes.
And that's the thing. She would always make up excuses for him. He had a reputation at this point. Can't hold down a job. He's not going to school. He's rude. He's spoiled. He's difficult to get along with. And she is blaming everybody but herself and Rhodes.
Whoa.
From 1928 to 1930, Daisy played the role of a grieving widow while in Johannesburg. She didn't go out much, and she wasn't seen dating anybody. The problem was, her money was running out. She attempted to get her old job back, but was unable to.
Rhodes had worked various jobs, but was often fired for poor performance. This caused a rift between the two of them. Neighbors would often hear them fighting, and it shocked those around them when suddenly they began getting along again and set off for a vacation to Zimbabwe to visit her surviving siblings.
Daisy's family did not care for Rhodes. They thought he was rude, lazy, and spoiled. Despite this, they thought Daisy was a wonderful mother to him. Oh, he's so difficult. You manage him so well.
It's like putting two and two together and getting seven.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? It's like, you're so good. Why is he behaving this way?
Yeah.
Maybe because it's not good.
Yeah.
Maybe because it's not.
And he would just scream at her.
Oh, yeah. When they returned back from their vacation, Daisy was thrilled to hear that Rhodes had gotten himself another job. He had practiced repairs on his motorbike and was now working as a repairman of service vehicles for the local government in nearby Bremersdorp.
And this was a good job.
Yeah, for the government.
Yeah, exactly. He had a real chance here. She visited him at work a few times, but every time she saw him, he would ask her for money and the two would fight about his spending habits. She also brought him various gifts and candies. On one visit, she brought along a will that she wanted him to sign off on in case he died while working.
Oh, man. If he was smart, he'd be like, I've seen you play this game before.
Yeah. And I mean, at this point, her kind of justification is everyone I have loved so far has died.
Fair enough.
You are the only thing I have left. Maybe you'll die too.
Mm-hmm.
And it also we'll get into it, but it also protected him in the case of her death.
That's true. And just as a point of order here on the Grimm curriculum, I would advise anyone to actually go out and get a will, especially if you're married or married with kids. We've had friends in the past who have had someone pass away and not gotten things set up properly. And boy, howdy, does it cause insane complications after. So sit down, have things just written out. It's a really good idea because shit happens.
And it sounds shady knowing what we know about her, the fact that she did this. But I mean, it does make sense because, like I said, every single person this woman touches dies.
It's kind of a dangerous place to be.
Yeah, that too.
With Rhodes gone, Daisy was lonely and decided that she might want to marry again. She met former rugby player Sidney Clarence de Melker, also known as Sleepy.
Sleepy is Afrikaans for nap, and it was a nickname given to him because he constantly looked like he was about to fall asleep at any minute.
So basically Sleepy. They're calling him Sleepy.
So Sidney is, he's a really interesting character because he's a little bit older. Not by much. But he was basically like a famous rugby player in his youth.
South Africa is one of the countries where they take their rugby very fucking seriously. Yeah.
And so a lot of people kind of saw him and they were like,
he's a bit of a celebrity.
He is. You know, he's done well for himself, but also why isn't he married? What's going on here? So they were kind of like, well, what's up with him? But she liked him.
Okay, fair enough. Sidney found work in Johannesburg as a plumber also. He had a 19-year-old daughter named Eileen, who Daisy seemed to get along with quite well. In early 1930, the two of them ran into Daisy, and before long, Daisy and Sleepy were dating.
On January 21st, 1931, the two were married. By now, Daisy was no prize peach. She was described as overweight, had bunions, wore dentures, and her hair was wild enough that it broke combs whenever she tried to brush it. I took that from an old article. Those are not my words.
I've probably admitted this before, but I've also broken a hair off, or a brush off in my hair before. So it's relatable. But
it happens.
Not as an adult, I will say.
Yeah. Despite this, the two seemed happy to have found each other.
Eileen and Rhodes were not happy with the nuptials. The two instantly disliked one another. Eileen told her father that Rhodes was a dimwit and that she was worried that he was actually dangerous. Rhodes, on the other hand, told Daisy that Eileen was nosy and would try to cause issues with their marriage. I think Eileen has him clocked.
I think so.
And he's him.
Yeah, he's Rhodes.
He's been Rhodes.
Daisy moved in with Sidney and Eileen. She was happy to leave her old home filled with sad memories and start a new life. She sold the house and signed a contract saying that the money would go only to Rhodes if she were to pass away.
Overall, Sidney was a good husband. Unlike Alf and Robert, he was in great health. The issue in her life now was Rhodes. Perhaps Eileen had been right about him. Soon after, Daisy was getting letters about his many violent fights while he was at work. It seemed that Rhodes was the instigator. She went to visit him in an attempt to calm him down, but he quit his job and moved in with her and her new family.
Rhodes often argued with both Sidney and Eileen. He was also starting to develop his own health issues. By now, his epilepsy had stopped, but he began having digestive problems.
Uh-oh. One morning, Rhodes had become so weak that Daisy, you guys called it, called a doctor. Upon examining the 20-year-old, it was concluded that he was suffering from malaria. This was not uncommon for their area, and he was prescribed with the appropriate medication. She mentioned to the doctor that she was a trained nurse and that she would look after her son, and therefore there was no need to take him to a hospital.
For 3 weeks, Daisy cared for Rhodes. He eventually was well enough to leave his bed, and soon enough he was on the job hunt once again. He found a new position driving a truck for a dry cleaning company. He was fired after only a few weeks due to his unlikable nature. He found another job as a mechanic, but that didn't last long either.
At home, his irritability only became worse. On one occasion, neighbors saw him take an axe to his own prized motorbike. Word began to spread that the young man was losing his mind. Daisy continued to defend him the best that she could.
Then one day, Rhodes hit his mother for the first time as Eileen and Sydney watched in horror.
Can I just say, the fact that Sydney is an ex-rugby player and he's just watched this idiot punch his mother? I mean, don't get me wrong, Sydney is an older man at this point and Rhodes is a 20-year-old. But I'm thinking an ex-rugby player could beat the wheels off of this snotty little 20-year-old.
Yeah.
I hope he does. But something on your face says he doesn't.
She had been telling them that she was worried about not his behavior, but his health. And she quickly forgave him.
Oh, goddammit. Sydney, fill him in.
Someone needs to do something.
Someone needs to do something.
Poor Eileen.
Oh, man. And especially because, I mean, so far, Eileen and Daisy seem to get along.
Yeah, they're fine.
And again, just putting my own thoughts into it. It's like, I wonder if having now all these issues with Rhodes and then seeing Eileen, and it's almost kind of like having a daughter for the first time and maybe seeing that Eileen kind of has her shit together and isn't being a massive problem. Meanwhile, Rhodes is still going off the rails and has now punched her in the face.
Yep.
Rough. Daisy began telling people that she was worried about his symptoms from malaria that were acting up. The real concern was that Rhodes was clearly depressed. He told multiple people that he was thinking about ending his life.
On March 2nd, 1932, Rhodes did not come home from work. His family was under the impression that he had gone off to play rugby. He arrived at home that night at 8 p.m., but refused dinner due to a headache that he said was the result of playing rugby in the heat. A few minutes later, he said he was going to go out with some friends.
The following morning, he went off to a new job. The family noticed that his skin had a yellow tinge to it, but he said that he was feeling fine. A few hours later, he arrived back at the house saying that he was feeling unwell. He put on his pajamas and went to bed.
The next day, he called Daisy into his bedroom and told her he was too sick to go into work. She called a doctor who said that Rhodes was suffering from a stomach bug and prescribed medication.
By March 5th that year, Rhodes was so sick that he couldn't even walk himself to the bathroom. A neighbor came by to check on him and was told that Rhodes wouldn't eat or drink. Together, Daisy and the neighbor force-fed him some brandy to help him feel better. To be fair, this sounds whack. And they are probably doing it for the wrong reasons. But if Rhodes is a heavy drinker and he's just gone cold turkey because he's not feeling good, withdrawals is probably not making him feel good either. So maybe a splash of brandy is what he needed.
This is probably something I shouldn't even say on the show.
Oh, no.
But, I mean, I'm Bosnian. We have our own methods and our own ways to do our old country medicine.
Totally.
When I was in grade four, I think, I stepped on a bee and it stung me. And I, like, flipped my shit. Oh. Like, I was screaming and thrashing and flailing. And we were camping with my aunt. And her and my mom gave me a shot of scotch. And I don't remember anything after that.
That sounds about right.
But I calmed down.
I mean, I thought you were going to say they cleaned the wound with alcohol, which I have done in the
past. Well, they did that too. Yeah. But
I do think, though, again, just off on a tendril, this episode is going to be like an hour and a half long at this point. But when you were a kid, being stung by a bee is like being assassinated.
Oh, yes. That's how I felt.
The fear of bees and wasps.
Yeah.
Like, I was so scared of them that even a fly coming too close to me would freak me out.
Oh, yeah.
And my mom would be like, Charlotte, it's a fly.
Yeah.
To be fair, I wasn't stung for the first time until I was like 14 or 15. So I kept away from those fuckers.
You did a good job. I didn't even see this motherfucker coming. I stepped on it.
Squash.
Yeah.
But he got you.
He got me.
Anywho. Daisy was unhappy with the doctor's initial diagnosis of Rhodes, so she called back the doctor who had treated Alf. Rhodes was given chloroform to help with the pain and slipped into a deep sleep. A few hours later, the doctor came back to check on him, but Rhodes would not wake up. The doctor injected him then with an unknown substance.
You guys are probably hearing the word unknown substance here a lot, because everything I found, it was so specific about, you know, the chloroform and things like that.
Sure.
But the tonics and the injections, it always says it was just, he wouldn't say what it was, or unknown substance or something like that. And it really made me wonder, what's he giving him?
Okay, I feel like this could go one of two ways.
Okay.
A, he being an old-timey doctor and he's just mixing shit and whipping shit together. And he's like, you know what? I don't want to explain this to you. It's the medicine.
Yeah.
The other option is that I don't know how to help this person. So I'm just going to inject him with whatever. And then I'll be like, yes, it's medicine. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know what else to do for this man.
Yeah.
It could have gone either way.
I mean, I think it's a bit of both, honestly.
Honestly.
That afternoon, it was clear that Rhodes had fallen into a coma. Daisy, Sydney, and various neighbors all watched as he succumbed to whatever was ailing him.
I can't help but feel that people around probably weren't super unhappy with this situation, because Rhodes was kind of a dick.
I hate to speak ill of the dead.
Of course.
But he was a tough person to like.
No kidding. Daisy called the doctor, again, to examine Rhodes and see if he was, in fact, actually dead. The doctor refused to issue a death certificate until an autopsy was performed. Upon inspecting his body, it was noted that his brain had hemorrhaged, his spleen and liver were swollen, and that the walls of his stomach were inflamed.
Less than a month later, Daisy received a check from the life insurance company. Had Rhodes not died, he was set to gain Daisy's entire fortune at the time of her own death. She then went to his workplace and demanded to be given his final paycheck. When she got home, Sydney was waiting to confront her.
Uh-oh. It turns out William Sproat, the doctor of Robert... Oh, the doctor. We've said doctor so many times. It turns out William Sproat, the brother of Robert Sproat, had heard about the death and spoke to the police. He found it suspicious that not only had two of Daisy's husbands died, but also now her son. He also suggested that it was quite strange that they all seemed to be experiencing very similar symptoms.
Fair point.
Yeah. You know, two is a coincidence.
Yeah.
Three is a problem.
Mm-hmm. He demanded that Alf, Rhodes, and Robert all be exhumed and examined, and he was sure that Daisy had something to do with their deaths.
On April 15th, police supervised a team of gravediggers as they gathered the bodies of the three men. This time, they tested the bodies for strange substances, and they found two, arsenic and strychnine.
There they are.
I knew, just based on the symptoms alone, I was like, it's giving arsenic and it's giving strychnine.
Yep.
And those are pretty classic 1920s.
Oh, yeah.
Poisons.
Definitely. It was clear that all three of them had been poisoned, and it was also more than obvious who had done it.
The following morning, Daisy heard a knock at her door. A man introduced himself as Chief Detective Constable J.C.H. Jansen. He asked if she was Daisy DeMelker and asked her to come with him for questioning. As they left the home, more officers arrived to search it.
Daisy was told she was being charged with the deaths of Alfred Cowell, Robert Sproat, and her son Rhodes. She was booked into the women's prison in Johannesburg. The following day, papers began reporting on the story saying that they already knew she was guilty of the crimes. And here's something very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So the prisons in that area were huge.
I believe it, yeah.
Now, one thing we didn't touch on about this particular time in history in this area and even now, racism is a huge, huge issue. And so this prison that she was sent to, the majority of the people who were there, the inmates, were Black.
Okay.
And very few of them were women. And they didn't house different races together.
No.
So when she got there, she was essentially the only white woman in the entire prison.
Oh, shit.
And they couldn't put her with everybody else.
Right.
So she was in her own little kind of spot in the prison that they kind of made out for her.
A where weird she had to stay. Situation for her to be in, but kind of the best case scenario for her, probably.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. And just to get off topic for a second, if you want to watch a really fantastic film about apartheid in South Africa, mm-hmm. I believe it's based on a true story, but it is a work of fiction. It's called The Power of One. It's a long movie, and I believe it has Morgan Freeman, plus a bunch of other famous actors mm-hmm. you'd recognize. Fantastic movie about apartheid and segregation in South Africa mm-hmm. at that time. It's fantastic. Definitely check it out. That being said, a man who worked with Rhodes had told police that he had suffered with severe stomach pain on March 4th. That day, he had drank coffee from Rhodes' thermos. He also told them that he remembered being told that Daisy made Rhodes his coffee every morning.
The police searched the home and found three thermoses. Two were broken and one was intact. It was tested, and arsenic residue was found inside. A local pharmacist told the police that he had sold Daisy arsenic on numerous occasions after she told him she needed it to kill some stray cats.
On October 17th, Daisy's trial started. She was at risk of hanging for her crimes if found guilty of even one of the murders. But Daisy wasn't worried. A writer would later describe her by saying,
"She made no attempts to look beautiful. Her lips were not reddened, nor her cheeks painted. She wore every day, for 6 weeks, the same black dress with the same lace front." Roasted.
He's like, "Bitch, you couldn't even glamour yourself up for court?"
So mean. They would do this today, though. Honestly, I feel they would. Court TV, I could see it happening.
I am in no way defending Daisy here. Like, she did what she did. But why do they always go in on the appearance? Always.
I know. Well, because we're women. That's the reality of it.
Even when men are convicted for things, they'll comment on, for example, like Menendez brothers. They dressed in like their little sweater vest and stuff, mm-hmm. right? Because it made them look a little better to people, whatever. And it's commented on, but it's just commented on as like, this is what they were wearing. Mm-hmm. Whereas I find when it's women, it's like, she was ugly and rotund and there were pustules on her face and she was unkempt and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, oh, okay, okay.
Well, during the Menendez trial, they kept talking shit about the one lawyer and how she looked.
Yes, like, I mean, exactly. It's wild. Anyway.
Yep.
Daisy's behavior shocked those who knew her. She would arrive at court smiling for all of the photographers, but would scowl at the public. She would later tell friends she had big plans to write a movie based on her life and star in it herself.
That is a true fact.
Dang. It's one thing to defend yourself in court.
Yeah, of course.
But she's like, I'm not worried about court. Six fucking seasons and a movie deal, bitch.
Yeah. And she would. She'd see the photographers and she'd smile and, you know, flick her wavy hair at them. And then she'd see all the people that are there to see her be put to death. Yeah. And she would just like scowl at them.
Okay, Daisy.
Daisy told Sydney that she was going to be acquitted due to lack of evidence. In terms of the trial, she had a choice of trial by jury or a trial by a judge and two assessors. She opted, with the advice of her lawyers, to not do a jury trial due to the public's perception of her.
Good call.
It was determined that she would only be charged with the murder of Rhodes due to lack of evidence when it came to her husband.
Speaking of her lawyers, they were certain that she was guilty and felt that the best they could do for her was to plead for clemency and be given life in prison. Her trial lasted 40 days. Daisy's biggest supporter was Sydney, who did not understand why a woman who cared for her son when he was ill would be guilty of killing him. He suggested that Rhodes had killed himself. I do understand his thinking kind of in this at this point, because she spoiled Rhodes, right? Like, her mm-hmm. whole life, this is her prodigal son. She spoiled yeah. him. She makes excuses for his bad behavior. So from Sydney's point of view, I can see him being like, it doesn't make sense, you know, to turn around and kill him seems counterproductive to all the effort you've been putting in.
One thing that I found that I couldn't fully confirm, so I didn't add it to the script, but I completely believe it, was Rhodes was 20 when he died.
Okay.
There was a portion of the life insurance policy that said that he would get some small sum of money
okay.
when he turned 21 years old.
Oh.
And there were people who had apparently, allegedly, overheard him telling his friends that one of the reasons why he felt like he didn't need to work was because he was going to get this money soon.
Oh, shit.
Which to me makes sense.
Yes. Because
a lot of the time, if, you know, let's say one of your parents dies, you get a certain sum of money when you turn 18 years old.
Yeah, like a trust fund situation. Yeah.
And I think that kind of went into play there. And I, with what we know about Daisy, it wouldn't shock me if in her mind, she has this son who, again, don't want to speak ill of the dead, but was a total shithead.
Yeah.
And he's going to get money, her money that she killed for.
Yeah.
She's not going to have it.
So, but, well, I could see both sides, though. I could see bump him off before he's 21, because then he doesn't get access. But then wait until he's 21, receives that access, kill him, get everything. She gets it all in the end, regardless.
Yeah, but who knows how fast he would have spent that money.
You know what? Knowing Rhodes, hookers and blow all the way.
Yeah.
On November 25th, Daisy was set to receive her final judgment. The courtroom was packed with witnesses who had all come by to see what the outcome would end up being.
The judge declared that Daisy was to be found guilty of the murder of her son and be sentenced to hang. She was taken back to the prison where she packed her belongings and was taken to Pretoria Central Prison to await her execution. Her sentence was carried out on December 30th. She maintained her innocence until death.
That is a speedy death row situation.
There's one article that I found that was about the executioners and the people who worked at the prison.
Okay.
And they were getting ready for like a New Year's Eve barbecue.
Okay.
And so they basically had it written in their kind of day planning that they were going to first execute her. She was executed at about noon.
Oh my God.
And that they were all really looking forward to this barbecue afterwards.
That reads like something from The Office.
Right? Like, oh, you guys, we're going to have this barbecue. You know, old Joe over there, he's bringing his famous potato salad and it's going to be great. But we got to do something first.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. So, Joey, he's going to do the barbecuing. And yeah, we have potato salad coming from Bob and she's going to bring the sweet tea. I feel like there's something else we need to do on December 30th. And I just can't remember. Oh, on Daisy's execution.
Gotta build those gallows.
Okay, guys. Well, it'll have to wait until that's done first.
And there were these like rookie officers.
Oh, God.
Who came to witness the execution as well. And they joined them at the barbecue.
It's giving Super Troopers,
right?
This is just bizarre. I mean, I'm laughing about it, but it's so morbid.
I know.
But again, yes, we're into the late 20s, early 30s at this point. We're not talking about like the penal colonies of Tasmania here, or by any means. Like, we're a little further in history. But the fact that people are, I mean, they're prison workers, so they're desensitized to it. But
this prison was primarily for people who are going to be executed.
So this was a daily thing.
Yeah, exactly. It happened all the time.
I will say again, the fact that she received her judgment November 25th and was dead by December 30th, just over a month.
No rights to appeal. They know you're guilty. You're done.
I mean, I guess. Hanging's about as final as it gets.
It seemed clear to everyone except for Daisy that her motive was more than obvious. They were like, she wanted the money.
She is the classic definition of a female serial killer in the sense that women kill for very different reasons to men.
Yeah.
And often the motives for women's murders are financial.
Yeah.
And also, she poisoned, which is also a very female killer thing to do.
Definitely.
So she checks those boxes.
We see it all the time with women. Like you said, it's financial. With men, more often than not, it has something to do with some form of sexual aggression or something along those lines. But women also, I mean, with the exception of very few, I'm thinking of Carla Faye Tucker and Catherine Knight, women tend to go or a less personal route when it comes to killing people, often poison.
Absolutely. And Daisy really did play the long game with this too.
The Black Widows often do.
Yeah, because they're sneaky.
Yeah.
It goes unnoticed. And a little wife would never do that.
Well, I think of someone who we haven't talked about in a million years, Belle Gunness.
Oh, Bella's classic.
She played that game for a long, long time.
That's the other thing, too, is we like to kind of give you a variety of topics, right? Like we talk about male serial killers, we talk about female killers, we talk old crimey, we talk new, we talk hoaxes, we talk UFOs. The tough thing when it comes to talking about female killers with you guys is that a lot of their cases are so similar.
Yes.
That you can almost tell the same story sometimes and just add in new characters when it comes to female killers. The other thing too is females tend to kill babies.
Yes.
And that's just something we don't like to talk about all the time.
That's something we're just really never going to discuss on this show. It's interesting that you say that though, because I was curious about how many women have been executed in South Africa. I could find three.
Oh.
The first one was about a decade prior to Daisy.
Okay.
Who killed, it was like one or two farmhands.
Okay.
Poisoned them.
Go figure.
And then you have Daisy.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's like you said, a lot of the time, it really is the same story. That's why we don't cover as many women as we do men, because women are serial killers a lot less of the time, of course.
Yeah.
But their stories can be very similar in a lot of ways in terms of the motive, the method of death, things like that. And I mean, at that point, it kind of just becomes repetitive.
With the exception of a few, obviously. Yeah. And like you said, you mentioned like Catherine Knight, those really like violent, volatile ones where it's like, whoa, that kind of came out of left field.
Yeah.
Women, like I said, they play the long game.
Yeah.
They assess the risk, right? Mm-hmm. They're not going to do really crazy, wild shit because that's going to get you caught. The idea is to not get caught.
Well, it's the idea of an impulsive serial killer versus, or a disorganized versus organized, right? Women, more often than not, are in that organized serial killer category because they, like you said, they play the long game.
Yeah.
They plan it.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time, because of the way that they would do it back then, if the doctors didn't know to look for that arsenic, they're getting away with it.
It's the classic Acqua Tofana sort of case.
There you go.
She's doing it for different reasons, I think. But, you know, that all being said, we are at the end of the story of Daisy de Melker, the Black Widow of South Africa.
Ooh.
Send us some more South African spooky, true crime, cryptid, whatever, UFOs, anything.
Ghost stories?
Hell yeah. Send them over. Because South Africa, a lot of history.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of history.
And I initially thought this was going to be a short episode.
Dina literally messaged me, was it last night?
Yeah.
And was like, hey, this is going to be a short episode. I have kind of come to the end of the research. I can't find anything else. And I was like, hey, that's okay. And then 5 minutes later, you were like, never mind, scratch that. Found an archive. Here we go.
I found one book and I started reading it. And I'm kind of like flipping through the pages online. And it was supposed to be about Daisy.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to chapter 5 and they still hadn't mentioned her. And I was like,
we don't have time for this.
Yeah, I'm like, I don't need to know about some guy who showed up there and what life was like in the country. Give me one chapter of that and then talk about the person you're writing about. But yeah, no, I happened to find all this information. I hope you guys enjoyed this one. It's just crazy what people will do for their own self-gain.
Yeah. Absolutely. All right, we're in the outro now, where, of course, we love to give a big shout out to all the wonderful listeners and all the folks that support us across the various internet platforms. But of course, we give a shout out to our grim VIPs who are our top tier on Patreon. So, without further ado, take it away, Dina.
A huge thank you to Atlantean Jedi, Judy, Steven Centauri, Paranoid Pop Rocks, Bob, Brian, Kevinus Musicus, Nova, Lisa, and Mayhem Mudkip.
Thank you, thank you. And shout out to everybody else on Patreon. There's also a free tier if you want to go check it out. We have early episode reveals every week for the free tier. And you can also do a week-long free trial. So if you want to check out the videos and you haven't watched those yet, but you want to, can do that.
We've also had a few people sign up for the first tier on Patreon, which is super appreciated as well. Any little bit that you guys can give helps keep the show running. We appreciate it. And a huge thank you to everyone who's interacting with all of our content online. It really pushes us up in the algorithm.
Yeah.
We had people get into a full verbal brawl over one of our Menendez brothers post that kind of just shocked me. It got really heated in there, but it's good for the engagement, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe try to just be kind to one another in the comments. That's all I'll say. We're allowed to have very different opinions. We talk about some very controversial things.
Of course.
But just keep it respectful. Everyone is welcome. Unless you're a dick.
Exactly.
In which case, you can get out.
Yeah. Well, thank you all so much for listening. This has been
The Grim Curriculum.
Okay, so my fact for you has to do with gaming.
Oh, I love.
I thought you would like
that. Yeah, of course.
So you probably know that Nintendo was originally a trading card game.
Yes.
That means that at the time of its creation, Nintendo and Jack the Ripper were around at the same time.
Ooh, I love that. And to add on to that, Coca-Cola would have been around at the same time too.
Yeah.
So technically, it would not have been out of place for Jack the Ripper to be drinking a Coke
while playing his Nintendo cards.
While playing Nintendo games. Bye.
Bye.